My sense is that postmodernism and deconstruction, whatever your preferred term, and the differences between the two of them might or might not be relevant, has run out of steam, to borrow again a phrase from here, I'm referencing Bruno Latour, but there was a lot of incredible value in challenging presumptions of authority, institutional power, canons that had fossilized in a particular way, naive ideas about progress and universality, etc. But a lot of people got stuck, caught in merely the act of negation. We got really good at tearing shit down, and we forgot that in order to really produce a better world, we have to be able to build as well as destroy.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is Season 2, Episode 4 of Damn the Absolute. We've had a more prolonged hiatus than I ever anticipated for this season. First off, I appreciate your patience. All I can say is that moving into a stone cottage built in the 1940s, while livable, has required a lot of renovations and a lot of work. Throw in establishing a small but beloved orchard, a bunch of vegetable beds, and a host of other projects, and it's been a really busy time. It's been a challenging but fruitful first year here in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and I have no regrets. I've learned a good deal about local food production and had many firsthand experiences connecting it with the pragmatist notion of focusing on fruits over roots. And this is an idea we've touched on many times in the past, and I'm confident we will touch on it a lot more in the future. But for now, I'm just grateful to continue exploring our relationship to ideas with you. Before we dig into this conversation on metamodernism, I invite you to consider submitting an essay to Eradicus. From theories of truth and the means of finding hope to the Pandora's box that is ChatGPT and all sorts of AI applications, as well as the consequences of Zen Buddhism in practice, members of the Eradicus community have been busy putting ideas into practice. And I would love for you to tell us about what ideas have been recently really resonant for you. Eradicus is always open to thoughtful submissions, and you can learn more about our submission guidelines at eradicus.co. Now, on to our show. The German philosopher Hegel gives us a useful tool for understanding the history of ideas and how they move. Thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. We can see this clearly in the movement from the Enlightenment to Romanticism, to modernism, and eventually to postmodernism. Each intellectual movement a reaction to its predecessor, integrating what works from the previous era with new solutions to meet the demands of new problems. But where does this leave us now? What comes next after postmodernism? Odds are we're already in this new intellectual movement. A growing number of people have become worn out with deconstruction and the postmodernist impulse to doubt everything, to dismantle every concept and institution. It's become apparent this exercise, which started out as emancipatory and liberating, has basically congealed into its own set of dogmas and less than productive ways of being. Eager to revitalize a more constructive mindset and free us from postmodernism's long shadow, as he calls it, Jason Ananda Josephson Storm makes a case for what he hopes will come next. He argues this in his recent book, Metamodernism, The Future of Theory. Chair and professor of religion and chair of science and technology studies at Williams College, he aims to take us through postmodernism to metamodernism, to establish a new approach to producing what he calls humble knowledge. He's trying to create a paradigm shift, not just describe what is happening right now. He believes metamodernism is about the future of all ideas, but especially the human sciences. And ultimately, metamodernism is about hope, as Jason says. It's a vision whose ethical and political goals are rooted in compassion and multi-species flourishing. And here are a few things we considered during our conversation. How does metamodernism utilize skepticism without falling prey to either nihilism or a dogmatic doubting of everything? Why has postmodernism possibly, and I say possibly, reached a dead end? What is the relationship between metamodernism and pragmatism? Naturally, we're all curious. And what pressing political or social problems can metamodernism help us solve? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Jason, welcome to the show.
It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm just getting over a little bit of a head cold. So listeners, I apologize if my voice is a little scratchy. Bear with me.
I appreciate you wrestling through that. We're going to start off in a place of humility, which I know you'll appreciate with your emphasis on humble knowledge. Jason, what's a view you've held as an adult you were relatively confident wasn't going to change that's actually shifted dramatically for you?
Yeah, I mean, I, as you might expect, have revised views about a whole bunch of things. But probably I'm going to give a view that is probably the one that is most germane to talk about in reference to the book that we're nominally discussing for today. I really changed my view about language in a very fundamental way. In graduate school, I was a big believer in a kind of broadly post-structuralist philosophy of language that your listeners might associate with figures like Richard Rorty. The basic idea is a kind of Neo-Wittgensteinian one. Language is a kind of set of games that meaning is a product of use. Mostly language just relates to other language. The idea is that a sign, for instance, is a relationship between a sound and an idea, but you bracket out the world. It has no necessary connection to the world. And I had already rejected a broadly, let's say, Kripkean idea of meaning in terms of just pure reference for reasons I could talk about in more detail, but basically because it couldn't deal with rhetoric, the famous Clark Kent problem. If you call him Clark Kent or Superman, that seems to be different. So meaning can't only be reference. And I had landed in a kind of Rortian or Neo-Saussurean view of language. But what happened was over time, I was spending a lot of my effort focused on questions of translation. And according to this broadly pro-structuralist view of translation, it was supposed to be impossible. This sounds weird, perhaps, to those of your listeners who might not have bought into this picture, but translation was supposed to be impossible. There were some ironies. I was reading Walter Benjamin's Critique of Translation in Translation, but there was something else. There was a more fundamental problem. Every work on the impossibility of translation provided a translation in order to show you what had been lost. If I'm going to tell you, as Derrida says, that the phrase he wore is untranslatable, Derrida goes on to tell you what he wore means. So in that respect, this made a big difference also because it appears in Kuhn. Those of you who are interested in philosophy of science, or again, who are deep into your Rorty, will note that the incommensurability of scientific paradigms is a central feature to what makes Kuhn seem so difficult, so problematic in a certain way. But it turns out that Kuhn has to do the same thing when he wants to tell you that you can't translate between Aristotelian and Newtonian physics. He translates between, or you can't compare them. He compares them and he translates between the two of them. So that started to bother me, but it was actually, so I started to worry that this whole impossibility of translation and its attendant ideas about language were wrong. But it was actually an encounter with a snow monkey that tripped me over the edge. I was out hiking in the woods in Japan doing some field work, and I encountered a snow monkey that was evidently trying to communicate with me or with its monkey peers with this kind of screeching call. And it made me think about the evolution of language and about how language might relate to the world. So just to expand a little on this, and this is probably the one point in our conversation I'll probably go overly expansive. I apologize. I'll be more succinct in later answers. I did a kind of transcendental deduction, modeling if there is a world, it doesn't have to be a particular kind of a world, but if there is a world in which that has a certain rough stability to it. It has to have sort of clusters of properties or aggregates. It has to be enough persistent in time that we literally don't fall off of it. It's the kind of a world that must exist if creatures like monkeys are going to evolve, if creatures like humans are going to evolve. It's the kind of the world that's going to have to exist if any kind of communication is possible. This kind of a world, and I'm trying to say, it could be any one of a bunch of different worlds. We could be living in a world exactly as described by modern science, or the Jehovah's Witnesses could be right, or the 10th century Taoists could be right. It doesn't matter so much for this theory. It's just the case that if there's a world and if there's communication in it, then we have to attend to the relationship between language and the world itself. And this led toward an answer for me to the evolution of language. Language must have evolved to take advantage of pre-existing perceptual systems. Humans and animals perceive the world via functional relevance or meaningfulness. And then I was able to argue in terms of meaning as inference. For instance, a gray cloud can mean rain. And then I'm building off of a lot more of that, about an asymmetry between sign production and sign consumption. I argue that we both consume voluntary and involuntary signs. I then emphasize on how signs are materialized, how meaning is produced by social creatures by materializing signs, and how even our thinking is often externalized. We calculate a tip by writing on a piece of paper. So meaning is not primarily in our heads. It is in things we produce, share, and exchange. Anyway, I go into a lot more detail on what I call an inferential theory of meaning or hylosemiotics in the book. But that was a total break in my old way of thinking about language, and it solved a whole bunch of problems for me, problems that had originated in graduate school.
So how does that might that connect to this idea that with philosophy of language, there's some camps of people who say we can't really know how well our language hooks up with reality? It sounds like what you were describing, your previous view was kind of in that camp, that we could not tell how well language hooked up with reality. It's kind of this playful tool that we have, and that hits you as something incomplete. You felt there was maybe something a little bit more, is it fair to say, a little bit more real about the nature of our language?
Well, what I would say is that I would argue that it turns out we're talking about really complex systems. So it's not the case. First, I want to reject the idea that we can find some perfect language, some super, you know, positivist logical language that will just instantly produce meaning. And I want to reject also some of Rorty's critique of the mind as the mirror of nature and representationalist accounts of language. But I want to say that judgments of similarity and difference are context dependent. They're fundamental to language, but they're not completely arbitrary. So let me give you an example. I'll get more complete if I give you an example. So let's take the term, let me think of an English word. Okay, the term berry. So we might know that the berry as a botanical category that botanists come up with includes cucumbers, but not strawberries. Okay, so that's a category that's been that's trying to track a particular property cluster. It's interested in the fruit that is produced from the ovary of a single flower, if I remember this right. And so that's valuable, but it sorts into the category of berry a whole bunch of things that an ordinary chef wouldn't sort into berry, like cucumbers or eggplants or whatever, or chili peppers. Those all count as berries, I think, in this view. So that's one linguistic way of tracking a set of property clusters. But the same word berry could have a culinary dimension to it. This is, in fact, we're talking about two different kinds, two different sets of property clusters in the world. And so the culinary berry, we want small, sweet things, for instance, where we would exclude the cucumbers but include the strawberries. And we could note that in both cases, the categories have gray areas. The gray areas are not just a feature of our language, but the fact that the world itself is vague, that categories and sharp category membership is not a feature of the world around them. So a category that doesn't capture any common clusters is not going to be that useful. Like if you came up with a word for berry that meant, I don't know, strawberries and a particular shade of yellow, and that was the only thing you were using in your term berry, it's not going to provide much utility for you. So all that is to say, what I think we get, and I argue in the book, we're often talking past each other much more than someone who is, let's say, a referential semantics person might presume. We mostly don't have the same categories in our heads. Like you and I might disagree about the edge cases of yellow or something like that, or what really counts as blue, or where the boundaries of Mount Greylock or a particular mountain start, all those things. And that's not actually a defect because the world itself is vague. It probably just has these property clusters to it. So we often don't agree about meaning, but we can roughly coordinate our inferences insofar as we can track similar features of the world. So language has a certain and a pragmatic utility. That pragmatic utility is not merely the language's And not merely its use in a particular language game, but its use in our perceptual inferential system that includes the world as part of what's licensing certain kinds of inferences and references. Probably got into a lot more detail than you needed there.
You're dropping all sorts of breadcrumbs or seeds we're going to gather up at the end of this episode. So let's give a little bit of a framework for listeners. Your new book, Metamodernism, The Future of Theory, very ambitious. Kudos to you for what you've been able to pack into a relatively small volume. I'd love to start out, how would you articulate what you mean by metamodernism? It's a term that's popped up over the last decade, including a little bit in pop culture, but how are you articulating metamodernism, what you're trying to do here?
So I came to the term rather late. And listeners to your podcast might want to know that the book went out originally for peer review under the title Absolute Disruption.
And very punk rock.
Yeah, very punk rock. As I think I mentioned to you in the past, I'm an old punk rocker and goth. So it was part of that. But it was more specifically a quote from Hegel: the spirit obtains its truth only when in its absolute disruption it finds itself. And here I'm translating absolute in Zerrissenheit as absolute disruption. But when it went out for review, people kept trying to describe it as an ism. They wanted to say, is this new materialism? Is this post-postmodernism? Whatever. And since folks wouldn't let it stand on its own, I started to think about where or what thinkers to which this work might relate. And I was reminded of reading I'd done in by a Nigerian art historian named Moyo Okadiji. And Moyo Okadiji had written had coined the term metamodernism. And I had come across it in a book about African and Jewish diasporic art. And what Okadiji described was metamodern artists, in which he included himself, who were trying to challenge and work through both modernism and postmodernism alike. And that really resonated with me. That was what I was trying to do, sort of extend, work through, deploy both of those, especially postmodernism. And in this respect, I'm a little bit different from other people who use the term metamodernism. For most people using it, they're trying to identify a particular feature of culture as metamodern. They're not so much, they're trying to describe things and see if they fit into that box. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to describe a pre-existing paradigm, but produce a paradigm shift. And I just happen to call it metamodernism. In part, I think that people who are interested in transcending both modernism and postmodernism might find a lot of things appealing in the broader philosophical set of positions I articulate in the book.
There's also something you do, Jason, at the beginning of the book, which I personally deeply appreciate. And I think a lot of authors, philosophers, and thinkers don't tend to do. And that was you at least bring to the forefront a little bit of your own personal background. And I think a lot of writers do us a disservice when they don't, because they reinforce this notion of a view from nowhere. And so I would love to have you sort of unpack this a little bit. You say you identify as queer, mixed race, Jewish, Buddhist, a lot to unpack there, amongst other things. In what ways does your background inform this project and some of your viewpoints?
Yeah, so I grew up with a sense of myself as at the intersection of at times competing identity positions. And all along, I will say, both sides of my family had a strong emphasis on education. And I was really lucky. I was an academic family. My parents are both PhDs. Three of my four grandparents taught college. I went to elite universities, Oxford, Harvard, Stanford, and I had a perpetual sense of myself as an insider outsider. I was in these privileged positions, institutions, but at the same time, I didn't fit in. And that drew me toward counter-hegemonic forms of theory, queer theory, critical theory, including critical race theory, post-colonial theory, and especially for family heritage reasons, Asian philosophy. And I found myself in that respect, both aware of the potentiality for these institutions to do great things and a continual frustration about their limitations. And so I think you'll see that the work as a whole, I draw from a much wider range of influences in terms of philosophical influences than a standard philosopher. You know, like I'm reading not only Nagarjuna and a little bit of Peirce and a lot of Derrida and what have you, but I think I have a focus on concerns that are relevant to those of us who have a sense of the limitations of the contemporary academy, the things that it fails. The thing, and without recognition that it does some things good. I mean, I feel I'm still a strong believer in education, but I think we could be doing a lot better.
Metamodernism, I think, and maybe you just mentioned this as well, there's an emphasis, or metamodernism, I think, comes up a lot in decolonial circles. At least it's starting to now. And it seems like a lot of people who are members of marginalized communities might resonate more with metamodernism than maybe people from more privileged backgrounds. Do you find that to be the case? I don't know if asking a demographic question here is fair for philosophers. It's more of a social science question, but I'd be curious to know if you're finding a certain resonance with certain groups of people.
Yeah, I'll say that Moyo Okadiji's formulation of metamodernism is more or less explicitly as a decolonial category. It's in part for the people that didn't fit in initially to notions of modernism or postmodernism. The future is not evenly distributed, to borrow a phrase often attributed to William Gibson, but who knows? And I found in terms of response to my work that there has been, I've been overwhelmed by the incredible diversity of folks who have been interested and have reacted to at least my formulation of metamodernism. I will say in particular, there's been a large uptake in Latin America. So there was a whole workshop on my book in Caracas. There's been significant conversations about it in Mexico at the moment. But even within the United States, a lot of the people who seem to be most excited about it are people who come from, at least in certain respects, marginalized communities, although not exclusively so. So, you know, I think it has a potential for an appeal that is broad, because there are also many different ways, both more or less visible, of being marginalized as well. So I think it attracts people who are dissatisfied with the status quo. And there are many people who are, for a lot of good reasons, dissatisfied with the status quo. I definitely see that in terms of the response to the work so far.
Metamodernism, some people are going to maybe latch on to the meta part, some on the modernism, which is interesting in and of itself. But for you, what I understand the project is really trying to take some of what's useful in modernism and postmodernism and kind of move us past it. It's sort of a hopeful attempt to get past the sort of exhausting landscape that is deconstruction. I wonder if you could articulate a little bit more of that aspect of metamodernism.
Yeah. So in a way, it's an attempt to, my sense is that postmodernism and deconstruction, whatever your preferred term, and the differences between the two of them might or might not be relevant, has run out of steam, to borrow again a phrase from here, I'm referencing Bruno Latour. But there was a lot of incredible value in challenging presumptions of authority, institutional power, canons that had fossilized in a particular way, naive ideas about progress and universality, etc. But a lot of people got stuck, caught in merely the act of negation. We got really good at tearing shit down, and we forgot that in order to really produce a better world, we have to be able to build as well as destroy. And so in a sort of abstract way, and I can get into more detail depending on where we go in this conversation, I think we need to not deny deconstruction, but start out from it. We don't deny the terrors, the suffering, and the injustice of our history. But rather than merely terminating in their recognition, we start out from them. We say, I'll just give you another example. In my pedagogy, when I start teaching, I don't try and hide all the shitty things that were in the European, let's say, colonial historical project. That would be so contrary to my pedagogy. It would be crazy. But instead of terminating in them, instead of having the class only identify what is fucked up, I have us begin with what is fucked up so we can figure out how to make the world better, how we can struggle together as fallible, as imperfect, as humans who have complex pasts and who are capable of recognizing and experiencing injustice. How do we not deny that injustice, but how do we then struggle together to build a better and brighter future? So it's not a denial of the postmodern or critical or negative impulse, but a deepening of it. And in a way, what I'm trying to do is also turn critique on itself. You can be critical of critique. You can see the limitations of the critical project. You can show us why just critiquing didn't have the positive effects that many of its early advocates thought it would. We got so good at, for instance, questioning authority that we ended up questioning ourselves and leaving authority intact, and leaving in place the very structures of power and inequality that we were trying to eliminate, we actually deepened them in certain respects. And so, again, postmodernism had some value to it. I'm not an anti-postmodernist, but I think that we can start out and consolidate some of its better positions while working through and repudiating others. And in doing so, it leads us to somewhere totally new, somewhere that I'll call metamodernism, and which I think stands on its own 2 feet, regardless of what you think about postmodernism. Maybe your listeners never heard above Derrida, don't care about postmodern deconstruction itself, have merely noticed a tone of negativity and scornful moralizing. In any case, that was an important phase, but it's a phase that we can work through and past, again, not by denying its value or its utility, but by focusing on remedying and working to make positive and constructive change.
As we're looking to move past postmodernism, I think it could be helpful to highlight some of the history here. I'm wondering if you can outline a little bit of, and I tend to see intellectual history in a very Hegelian way. That's how it was taught to me. I think of intellectual history being introduced in the Western canon, so to speak, to the Enlightenment period, and in reaction to what was perceived as the excesses of the Enlightenment. You had the Romantic period, and then in response to some of those excesses, you had modernism, and then in reaction to that, you had postmodernism. I'm wondering if you could briefly walk us through a little bit so listeners have a little bit more of a sense of what each of these very contradictory traditions tend to mean for people.
I'm there with you on the Hegel in a certain respect. I think that Hegel's account of the movement of ideas, what's often called his dialectic, is incredibly valuable, at least for interrogating what gets called postmodernism, if not everything else. And so I don't want to take us to take too long. So I'll start from this postmodern position, and rather than tracing all of intellectual history before then. But if you want to read my book, previous book, my second book is a critique of the category of modernity. So stuff about modernism and modernity are in that book as well. It's called The Myth of Disenchantment, if your listeners are curious. So what I'm interested in terms of postmodernism, that term has a certain kind of, has been used in a bunch of different ways. And what, to describe everything from art movements to literature, to architecture, to philosophy. And most, the art and the aesthetic things that were most often associated with that term are way heavily out of vogue. Fred Jameson and Lyotard, and their account of what was supposed to be postmodernism in literature, nobody reads that stuff anymore. Nobody reads Alain Rogrullier, for instance, or the famous postmodern architects have long since passed out of vogue. But the constellation of ideas that were often described as postmodernism in philosophy continue to be, for a long time, taught either in a whole range of academic departments. And basically, I want to say that there's something arbitrary about what gets labeled postmodernism. It's not a universal historical trajectory. It's not the case that it emerged organically, perhaps from the specificity of modernism, but rather it had it had something to do with the changing structures of the academy in the period of the post-war period and the lead into the 60s and 70s and a rise of different kinds of cynicism and skeptical theory in that moment. But basically, postmodernism and philosophy was anthologized together by mostly in an Anglo-American context, by drawing on theorists who were themselves often French or German, who didn't like each other necessarily, and who often disagreed about pretty fundamental issues. And I trace this history in the first chapter of the book a little bit, but the payoff is that you won't ever solve or understand postmodernism if you merely are focused on Derrida, for instance, because there are ways in which parts of his thought have been extracted and used as fuel, but others haven't. Instead, I identify postmodernism with a constellation of, broadly speaking, 5 philosophical positions or themes. 1, a charge of anti-realism or questions about the limits of realism. 2, a broader skeptical crisis. 3, a question about the relationship between value and scholarly study, a critique of values, a kind of negative or anti-value oriented position. 4, which is sometimes called either ethical nihilism or ethical relativism, and the differences are more or less important at different times. 4, a notion of language that we could call the post-structuralist or broadly Rorty-ian view of language, although he's not.
And that's largely what we talked about at the beginning.
And 5, a breakdown in the notion of the concept or how social categories are put together, the failure of the grand project of conceptual analysis or producing definition. And all of these, I want to argue, are real philosophical problems. So analytic philosophers who think that they can just laugh postmodernism out of the room and say it's obscurantist, it's junk, they're actually feeding the postmodern sense of energy and what have you. Instead, these are real problems, and problems that didn't originate in the 1970s, clearly, but they have long antecedents. But they're things that matter, and they matter not only for scholars, but they should matter for ordinary folk, because questions about ethics, questions about how we come to understand the world, questions about language and how it works, and questions about society and how it's put together. That matters no matter whether you're a banker or a carpenter or an academic. And so I think the postmodernist answers to all those issues, while they were leaned heavily into the skeptical side of them. And this is the way where, to gesture back earlier, a notion of Hegel can be really valuable. Most of the postmodern formulations are themselves negations. What postmodern, deconstruction, anti-essentialism. And Hegel has a fabulous way of writing about how you deal with negations. His dialectic, often misdescribed as thesis, antithesis, synthesis, was actually limited abstraction, skeptical moment, and then the negation of the negation. This is the moment in which philosophy advances for Hegel. And there's some debates in Hegel studies about how to interpret that position. I take one line on it. I'm not trying to convince everyone to be a Hegelian. I don't know that I think there's a lot to critique about his broader system, but I think he's right about this, which is the case that you can, part of the way that you move past skepticism is by granting certain kinds of skeptical conclusions and pivoting on them. I think Hegel had in mind, for instance, Kant's response to Hume, where Kant turns Humean skepticism into a foundation for his transcendental deduction, not by denying that we have a reason to be skeptical, but by imagining structures of cognition in which that skepticism itself becomes possible, perhaps. And so I tried to take as points of inspiration a Hegelian negation of the negation around postmodernism in these five areas. But again, I just want to really underscore this because some people who look at the back cover of my book but don't go further, I think the book stands on its own. The end result, the positions, the attitudes toward knowledge, language, and the world matter and are valuable and are useful and have pragmatic utility. I'll use that formulation because you're a pragmatist podcast, regardless of what the original sources of inspiration. And even if you think Hegel is bunko, it doesn't matter that much because the payoff is there.
You mentioned a whole bunch of the issues that exist or are identified by postmodernism and then linger with us. And as someone who's very sympathetic to a lot of these postmodernist stances, I appreciate your point of feeling tired of the cynicism and the negating of everything and the doubting of everything to the point that knowledge doesn't quite seem possible. And metamodernism is this like construction project, this hope for what we can build. And I'd like to sort of turn more towards some of these positive things that I feel you want to talk about. And you address a few of them. One of them is the debates between realism and anti-realism. And you talk about modes of realism, but you feel like these debates between realists and anti-realists are kind of muddied and not super helpful. Why do you find the debates or the framing of realists and anti-realists not super useful?
As I argue in the book, a lot of academic disciplines at this historical moment have fault lines that have caused them to be organized into opposing camps. Some folks get called realists, some folks get called anti-realists. Mostly they tend to be talking past each other, in part because they both tend to grant that the world, that they're sort of fighting over the scientific paradigm, and neither of them are actually denying the existence of a world. So often anti-realists are accused of thinking that the whole world is a fable, but what they're actually fighting about is confidence in the scientific paradigm. Most of the people who are doing the fights are not themselves scientists. And in part, I want to argue most fundamentally, they're talking past each other because they have different notions of what it means to be real. In some cases, you have a split where it's realists versus social constructivists, with the presumption that to be socially constructed makes something not real. Mm-hmm. And I argue that that's way too limiting for a whole range of reasons. But in the first case, I observe that the term real is often a contrasting term that gets most of its meaning out of an implicit and often unstated contrast. Let me give you an example.
Yeah, what's an example here?
Yeah, if I tell you that that guy is not the real Elvis, I could be saying that he's not the real Elvis because he is not Elvis Presley. Or I could be saying that that guy's not the real Elvis because that guy's a hallucination. Or I could be telling you that that guy's not the real Elvis because he's a statue, or because his name is Jimmy, or that his name is Elvis, but his name is not Elvis Presley. I mean, you know, or what have you. So it would turn out that some versions of this, not the real Elvis, are hallucinations. Some of them are statues. Some of them are, I don't know, robots. Some of them are people, but just different people. All that suggests that the way that we're using the term real is typically contrastive. And on top of that, I want to suggest that The implicit contrast in many academic contexts is between real versus mind dependent. But so is it real or is it socially constructed or is it mind dependent? But it turns out that there are many ways that something can be mind dependent. Let me give you an example. One kind of mind dependence might be causal mind dependence, as I argue in the book. Something might be mind dependent insofar as a mind brought it into existence. Let's take a car. A car is causally mind dependent because it wouldn't exist if there weren't any minds. But a car can run you over. So it would be kind of silly to be standing at the intersection yelling out that cars aren't real, right? So cars can be both socially constructed and then, depending on what your contrast term is, real. And so it turns out that a causal mind dependence isn't the only way. I explain in some detail in the book, and this is part of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about modes of the real, not some weird and mystifying thing, but different ways that things might be causally mind dependent or socially constructed. Sometimes things are socially constructed or mind dependent because they exist only in a person's head. So for instance, my favorite The Coop album is something that exists only in my head, but that but it is a thing, and you can make true statements about the thing that's in my head because it is my favorite The Coop album. It also became the movie Sorry to Bother You, which is also a great film I would recommend your listeners check out if they haven't already. All that is to say, the distinction between realism and anti-realism turns out to be too imprecise. And concretely, historically, folks are often located on the side of realism or anti-realism who identify one way or the other, who have competing and very contrasting views. For instance, if you think of critical realists like Quentin Meillassoux, just in case your listeners have heard of him, he's a speculative realist. He believes in a world in which everything could suddenly change, in a world of radical and complete and total flux. And that position, in a way, makes him much less confident about the most generalizations than many of the people who are anti-realists. So, or you could be accused of being an anti-realist because you're Richard Rorty and you're denying an appearance essence distinction. Or you could be accused of being an anti-realist because you actually think that there is a fundamental essence that is unknowable, as in Derrida, or something like that, an essence that transcends language, or a real, I guess in Derrida's terms, not an essence, but a real that transcends language. So anyway, so instead of that, I argue that we can have a much more productive orientation toward the subject of our knowledge if we recognize that instead of thinking of that there are different ways for things to be mind-dependent or socially constructed. Things could be causally, ontologically, classificatory, without denying social construction. So in summary, in the first case, real is a contrastive category, which gets its meaning out of an implicit contrast, which is often not stated. When the contrast is between real and socially constructed, that's often a mistaken view because there are many different ways for things to be mind-dependent or socially constructed. So the question should be not, is it real or socially constructed, but rather, by what process was this social thing made real? And that's what I then start to explore in a social ontology that I argue for in the book.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here, doing that podcaster thing and inviting you to rate and review Damn the Absolute wherever you listen to podcasts. It means a lot to me and the editorial team at Eradicus, who produces the podcast. Plus, it helps us continue bringing you meaningful conversations around fruitful ideas. Enjoy the rest of the show. So Jason, there are a few things that often come up in conversations about realism. And I think two of them, one is there's people often want to make a hierarchy out of what's real, not just whether something is real or not, but what's more real. And I think this feeds into this idea of a true singular essence about the world. Let me give maybe an example, and maybe you can make a little bit of sense of this. I think of the example of, imagine you're walking into a park and you encounter a wooden plane that has four cylindrical shapes descending from it. If I'm someone who's experiencing homelessness, I see this object, to me, that is a shelter. If another person comes up and maybe they're cold and they think, you know what, that's firewood. Someone else walks up with a basket full of food and sandwiches and a date, and they go, oh, that's a table. Is there a way in which any of those statements is more true than the other? And how might a metamodernist approach the question of the hierarchy of what is more true than something else?
Well, I think in that case, what we're talking about is different. Each of those different views is a different attempting to track a different set of property clusters of a complex world. So it's not the case that one of them, that a straightforward hierarchy exists in this account, but there it is also the case, unlike certain forms of relativism that all descriptions are equally useful or valid. I prefer useful rather than valid. But so, you know, if a guy is like, that's a unicorn, it probably not in a meaningful way, right? The same object that other folks are describing in terms of its combustibility or its utility as a shelter or what have you. So that means that there is a plurality of the things that we encounter, but not an infinite relativistic regress. I also would prefer not to use, or I don't use the word real exactly in that situation. I don't think that there's a hierarchy of real, but the other things that I think that the term real can obscure is a difference between existence and how, so predicate of being, basically. Like, we often think that the term real and exists are the same thing, but I argue that there are different ways for things to exist. Now, I'm not trying to be mystifying about this. I talk about modes of existence, but what I'm trying to suggest is an exploration of what philosophers have called ontological grounding. For certain, so the way that what it means to be existing for different categories of entities seems to be different. Let me give you a concrete example. When I say there is a number between 5 and 8 or something like that, or there's a number between 5 and 7, what is that is that I'm talking about? How does a number exist? Or similarly, we can talk about events. Events don't exist in the same way that objects exist. Events exist in terms of time slices, etc. Or absences. What is it that makes a hole in a bagel exist? And all these are different ways of pointing at kinds of ontological dependency, which complexify simplistic accounts of existence. The grand Parmenidean legacy of much of Western philosophy, which one could more or less, we could overread that, but presumes that being or existence is a primary and it's univocal. There's one kind of being. But actually, I want to argue that in a non-mystifying way, that there are different ways that things can exist and that to exist isn't the same thing as to have properties. So I'm not making an existence property confusion. But anyway, that's in terms of the real, then, in terms of whether something is real or not, what I want to suggest is that we always have to keep the implicit contrast in mind. And in that respect, we can clarify when one guy says that is not a real bench or something, what is he actually getting at or what have you?
So let me throw another thought into this, and that's the distinctions that people make between, as you suggested, of maybe natural kinds and what you talk about as social kinds. For example, I think a lot of more materially minded people are going to say that physical objects are more real are more real than, say, mind-dependent or socially constructed concepts. Is that something that rubs you the wrong way?
It definitely does, especially because I want to argue that, I mean, people could be saying a bunch of different things by that. What they could be saying when you're saying physical objects are more real than social objects is, I don't know, that they have a longer history to them or something like that, or that they could be saying that everybody would understand them or describe them the same way, which I might disagree with. But in particular, also, I want to argue that there are limitations in the standard account of natural kinds. So part of the problem is that natural kinds are often supposed to have a whole bunch of independent features. Like, they're different theorists of natural kinds, but they're often supposed to share essences, definability according to necessary and sufficient conditions. They're supposed to be mind independent. Often theorists think that they have intrinsicality, which is to say are supposed to possess properties they do independent of their connection to everything else. Microstructure, modal necessity. They're not supposed to cross-cut, all these things. And it turns out when you get there, almost nothing fits in the notion of natural kind. Arguably, atomic elements, as I make a hedge in the book, maybe. But outside of that, we've held up too high a standard to category of natural kind. And so most, for instance, at the very least, the things that I'm most interested in, which are humans and other social animals, none of our world fits into that notion of natural kind. And nor do most biological creatures. Species aren't natural kinds in this view. So in the way that people would rigorously want to define natural kinds. And so it would seem that this notion of natural kind is itself overinflated and is very weak because it's easy to challenge on skeptical grounds for a whole bunch of different ways. So if what somebody is interested in, anyway, so I could take us in a further tangent about social kinds and what makes them tick. But I'll say, yeah, that there are strong limitations in the very notion of natural kind itself. And philosophers who've wanted to ground language, for instance, in reference to natural kinds, turns out that there's not much that language could do because there are not many things that have. Natural kinds are often supposed to track the joints of nature, but nature, as I've been arguing, is not so much is not jointed in that way. It's much more full of sororities, of heaps, lumps, or aggregates, property clusters. Things cluster together, sure. So the nature is not one undifferentiated whole. But on the other hand, they're not clear joints at which nature can be divided. And I'll add, and I think that the very human versus nature distinction or nature versus culture distinction, which underlies a lot of this, is misguided. One of my main sources of inspiration, as I hope I made clear in my monkey at the very beginning, is taking very seriously other kinds of social creatures. So it's not just the case that humans produce social kinds, but actually ants produce social kinds, or wolf packs produce social kinds, or the world is overflowing with creatures that are producing meaning and things that have properties that are different than themselves, which is part of how I define social kinds. And so in that respect, this whole nature-culture divide was a mistaken set of presuppositions to begin with.
Yeah, it seems a lot of the time when people are either talking about natural kinds or mind independent realities, nature versus culture, it's sort of these dichotomies that tend to create similar camps, maybe opposed to each other, people who present it and frame it this way are trying to say, regardless of what you and I might say about a certain social or natural object in the world, that some people are trying to say there is this reality that is out there, that whether humans ever existed or not, it would still be true what I'm saying about this object that is in the natural world.
So I think that there are a couple different kinds of problems or confusions that we could get into. One is, are there things that would exist and be categorized together in the same way that humans categorize them together before there were humans or without humans? And that turns out to be a self-defeating game. Or is it the case that there are things that preceded humans? Yes, I don't want to suggest that the universe came into existence with a human individual behind it. But I want to suggest that, to make a kind of pragmatist move, it's a somewhat futile philosophical gesture to over-worry about a reality that is fully independent of humans, because we're humans and we're humans exploring the reality, the world that we're in. That said, I think when we're talking about specific entities, when we're arguing, did quarks, for instance, pre-exist humans, or, you know, are they, sometimes we say, are quarks real? And by real, we mean, are they merely an artifact of our data or not? That's actually a very viable question. That's a question within physics, though. And so part of the whole point of physics is, for instance, to try and make claims about those sort of things. And I think as philosophers of science, we can presume that some of the categories that we're ways that we're describing the world have more or less regular utility to them and validity, and some of them don't, but we don't necessarily know. And I think also one of the things I'm arguing in the book is that science itself is a social kind, and for that reason, it doesn't have discrete boundaries. It's an unfolding process in a particular way, and there are a whole bunch of debates that turn out to be about defending or attacking quote unquote science. But science isn't a unity, and if you recognize that, then a lot of those debates fade away. So fights about quarks, for example, Pickering's famous account of the social construction of quarks, is often taken as a critique of all of science, in part because he pitched it that way. But at point of fact, it's actually has the stakes are much, much, much lower. Even if quarks turn out to be merely an artifact of our data, of our measuring instruments, that wouldn't undermine claims about gravity or what have you. You know, they're totally independent or largely independent. So for that reason, so in that respect, I think we have too blunt of an instrument when we try and make certain kinds of distinctions, like when we presume that to be real is to exist or not to exist, for instance, or when we talk about the social construction of scientific theories. Yes, of course, scientific theories are socially constructed because we're social creatures, but they can have a better or worse capacity to track certain kinds of property clusters.
You've nodded to this several times, so I think we're going to enter this doorway of the relationship between metamodernism and pragmatism. I personally feel a lot of kinship. I'm not going to say it's pragmatism by another name. And you've, of course, mentioned Rorty. In your book, you mentioned Charles Peirce. You also give a nod to Hilary Putnam. What do you see the relationship being between pragmatism and metamodernism?
Yeah, I could write like a whole long thing about this, but I'll try and be very succinct. Definitely, pragmatism is one of my influences, not a central influence by any means, but I read Peirce, James, Putnam, Rorty especially. Also, I was lucky enough to be at Stanford when Rorty was at Stanford, and Cornel West I've overlapped with at various points. Again, with me as a student, not on the same plane as those dudes at all. And Peirce's account of induction was an influence, as well as his theory of signs, although I depart quite far from both. And I share with a pragmatist, I would say, a critique of a delusional quest for certainty. And I share probably a healthy skepticism about some forms of academic bullshit. Although I do think abstraction and metaphysics have a kind of value, and I do think that things are often not what they appear, so that there is a value in unmasking appearances. And so some versions of pragmatism, which are anti-appearance, you know, they want to reduce everything to appearance and deny metaphysics, I think, run aground. But more fundamentally, I would say my difference between Peirce and Rorty, one is the philosophy of language, but second, I think that Peirce and Rorty have opposite problems about convergence. Peirce famously argues for truth as the ultimate product of convergence, and I think that's wrong. It presumes way too much of a unity of science that I want to argue against. But Rorty makes the opposite mistake. He presumes a lack of convergence, that all that's going to happen is competing language games. And in that respect, I think he's equally wrong. As most, insofar as, you know, one of my other hats is as a historian of science, Robert Merton famously observed that multiples are common in scientific discoveries. You have independent scientific discoveries. For instance, magnetism has been come to by very different cultures and civilizations. So it's not the case that it is merely language games, but that there must be a reason we need to be able to explain why there are what convergences that there are. Not that everything will eventually converge. In fact, I would strongly resist that view, but Rorty is incapable of explaining why there is any convergence at all. And for that reason, it takes us back to the philosophy of language stuff that I've been talking about. And then finally, toward an orientation toward knowledge, which, while not incompatible with a kind of pragmatist fallibilism, in many ways I love that stuff, is a sort of a slightly different meta epistemology. I don't know that we may or might not have time to go into, but I'll just gesture readers to the book to think about it as an alternate epistemological stance.
You've said enough to ruffle the feathers of the Peirceans and the Rortians. Is there anything, any commentary you have that might ruffle the feathers of William James fans?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not as deep into James as some others are, but I think James's notion of good to believe as a pragmatic criterion is too easily decays into forms of atomizing relativism. And while I agree with the critique of a certain foundationalism, a critique of a foundationalist notion of truth, I think he doesn't have, often, at least, he's read as advocating if it's good for you to believe this, then you just sort of should believe it, a level camp in which that goodness is hyper-individualistic and is under-constrained. Similarly, James and company, maybe this gets back to the question of fallibilism and its limits, often describe and pathologize notions of doubt. And so part of the problem, even though I agree with them that we need a kind of humble knowledge or fallibilism, I think that we can afford to be in a position where, and maybe even should be, where we're not anti-skeptical, but hyper-skeptical, so skeptical that we're skeptical also of skepticism and able to work out the other side. And for that reason, again, my James isn't as thick, but he has critiques of, I forget what he calls it, but like morbid thinking that are excessively skeptical. And actually, I think that the way to cure that morbidity is not to find a sweet spot between good thinking and morbid thinking, but rather to deepen and work through and out the other side of the illness that is skepticism itself. And I think we can do that in a very different way than some pragmatists have thought was the case. But I'm not as deep in James as some of the other thinkers, so your readers may find more to object, or listeners, sorry.
I have one more pragmatist question for you. This actually comes from Nick Gall, whose Twitter handle is ironic, and he's also contributed at Radicus. Big Rorty fan, heads up. But he has a question for you about tragic pluralism. And as I understand, what he's mentioning here in tragic pluralism is this notion that we have all these values that they tend to conflict, that there's no way in which, as I pursue perhaps the value of equality, that I can pursue equality in a way that's not going to either undermine or create some type of contradiction or conflict with a bunch of other values that I may have or that my community may have. And so this question that he has is, there are many mentions of pluralism in the book Metamodernism, but I couldn't find any discussion of tragic pluralism. I don't see how metamodernism deals with value pluralism in a way that acknowledges perpetual conflict of values. One almost gets the impression that metamodernism will eliminate tragic pluralism. And I think he is also talking here about there's not a utopia. There's always going to be disagreement. So I was wondering if you could address Nick's questions here.
Sure. So one of the things I haven't talked much about in this conversation so far is that the ethical structure that I posit out the other side of postmodern critique, scornful ethics, basically, is I argue for a kind of critical theory plus virtue ethics, which is, I'll admit, is the least innovative part of the book, is that particular project, but I think it's important. And what I draw from virtue ethics, and not merely in its Greek formulation, but also drawing on influences from other world philosophical figures like Confucius and Shantideva, etc., is an emphasis on the utility, the value, the fundamental value of living a life worth having lived, and the idea that a better world is possible, that we can work together to produce communities that contribute to human flourishing. And not just human, but multi-species flourishing. One of the things that I depart from in terms of many contemporary virtue ethicists is that many virtue ethicists end up with a kind of selfish account of human flourishing, where basically you flourish on your own. But I argue that we come to ourselves in a world and in a community, in relationship to other people. And for that reason, I follow a particular thread in virtue ethics that emphasizes compassion as central to the project of human flourishing. You can't flourish fully in an unjust community. And this is how this relates to what Ironic is calling tragic pluralism, although that term or phrase is not one that I had heard before. So I think that what I'm aspiring toward, what I'm arguing for is, as I make fairly explicitly, a pluralistic landscape, because we have many different possible ways that we might flourish. There are many different kinds of values that we might have in our society. But as long as we have some commitment to a notion of compassion, we can produce agonism without antagonism, if I had to put a phrase on this. What I mean is to say, disagreement of itself is not a bad thing. Actually, I'm probably much more friendly to disagreement than other people with my larger left-leaning politics are, perhaps. I'm fine with hell, just to get autobiographical, my family loves to argue. We just argue with each other constantly. But we know that at the end of the day, we care about and respect each other, even if we don't ultimately converge on a particular view or set of views. So what we need to avoid as cultures and societies, you know, as communities, I'll put it that way, what we need to avoid as communities is violence, is when that agonism spills over to a kind of antagonism that comes to produce active forms of violent conflict in different ways. And we can talk about the limits of what counts and should be understood as systematic violence, in more detail. But in that respect, what the end position that I'm describing is one in which pluralism isn't tragic. Pluralism, as actually part of how we flourish, is coming to have our views challenged, coming to part of how we grow as intellectuals, as thinkers, is precisely through argument and disagreement. Part of the way that we resolve and grow our values, we have some idea that if you argue with people about values, you're just going to end up hating each other. Sometimes you actually do persuade each other. It's not necessarily by rationalization, but by, as far as the sociological evidence suggests, it's more like by telling empathetic stories, but we can produce some convergence of values. And in other cases, we can agree to disagree. And I think it's actually okay. It's actually okay to agree to disagree, as long as we recognize that certain kinds of violence, certain kinds of antagonism are off the table in some way or another. So, and then what we end up with is not some naive utopia where everybody has the same views and it's produces a kind of homogenization, but rather a utopia that continues to change and grow and that unfolds precisely because it is a heterotopia, a utopia of difference, a utopia of diversity and a utopia of change.
We're talking a little bit here at the end there of change and maybe progress. And I really appreciate the efforts people make to bring very complex, more academic ideas out into the public square. And I think social construction is a concept that has made its way into mainstream discussions of politics, especially around gender, sexuality, et cetera, race. What is the benefit you see in calling something a social construct, and how might we use those notions around social kinds or social construction to bring about social and political progress in your view?
Yeah. So in the first instance, there's a lot of folks talking past each other because of presumptions that social construction describes something as unreal. So if you tell somebody that race is a social construct, sometimes it could be, that could be the claim that people don't experience racism, which would be totally misguided. Or you could be saying, if you're saying that social, so that race is socially constructed or race is not real, that race is not a meaningful biological category, something I would strongly agree with. So instead, what recognition of social construction lets us do, especially when added to a kind of metamodern notion of a new account of orientation toward the real, is it lets us be much more specific about what we're talking about. So that's the first piece. But the second piece that's, I think, equally important is once we recognize that the social kinds that have often been used to categorize us and contain us have themselves been socially constructed, that gives us a new way to challenge them. A lot of people, and I get this from my students from a host of backgrounds, feel trapped in the categories imposed on them by society, by family, by a cultural upbringing, or what have you. Recognition of social construction is the first step toward recognizing their contingency, recognizing that these things that we have hitherto thought of as fettering us can be liberated. We can liberate ourselves from them, but also with a recognition of social kinds that is not merely negative, we can show how these social kinds can be positively produced and positively changed and authored, how they can take on new meaning, how we can build new social kinds, how we can find social kinds that contribute better toward human flourishing. I think more fundamentally, re-theorizing culture and society can help us with social leadership as well, because instead of, there's this, I want to argue in the book for a process social ontology, these things are always changing and we might not recognize it. So for instance, properties have flipped from one political party to another. Guns, for example, having public access to guns was a left-wing position because it was about resisting the domination of a conservative state, and then it became a right-wing position. Telling people that these have shifted categories, or abortion, for instance, which has gone from a Catholic issue to a Protestant issue, can help us relativize or downgrade conflicts that appear between these different social identity formations. Letting people know that positions have shifted between the Democratic and Republican Party, for instance, can help us relativize or limit some of the ongoing tips toward antagonism rather than agonism that I think is healthy and for human democracy. So for those reasons, I think that notions of social construction can really help us downgrade certain features of our contemporary, eternal culture war, but also help us not merely, it's not merely the act of unmasking something as a social construction, but talking about how we might better construct the social world that I advocate for in metamodernism.
There's a lot of projects, it sounds like, that have, in listening to other interviews, that have started to come together around metamodernism, collaborations that sound very exciting. Metamodernism still seems fairly contained inside academic circles right now. What are some areas in maybe pop culture, politics, or just general attitudes in the public that you encounter go, oh, that's metamodernism. It's starting to trickle its way out.
Yeah, I tend not to use metamodernism in that way. I know some other people do. They're like, I don't know, whatever movie, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is metamodern or something. I mean, whatever. That's not how I use the category. What I would say to try and respond to your question is that I've been delighted at the response to the book. Again, because I'm sort of out on a limb because that's maybe not the right metaphor. I'm trying to push a particular paradigm shift. But I've been really delighted at the response of the book, both by academics and non-academics, more so than either of my earlier two books. People, for example, a union organizer in Chicago who was interested in the book and figuring out how theory of social kinds could help make better social change, or somebody doing housing justice work in New Haven is interested in deploying pieces of the book's emphasis on human flourishing to make a better case for certain counts of housing justice, or artists, like I've delighted this tattoo artists in Barcelona who've been inspired, or a visual artist in Great Britain. So, I mean, I've been really delighted at the reverberations of this book, necessarily within the academy. Mostly I get positive letters from junior faculty or graduate students, people in somewhat precarious positions and related to the Kemperick Academy, but it has spiraled out into the world at large.
One last question before you go, Jason. What's the next project or related book you got coming down the road?
I have two two books in progress. The one that's closer to done is called The Genealogy of Genealogy. It's about, academics use this word genealogy in a really weird way. We use it to describe a kind of critical historiography, where if academics are going to do a genealogy of structure, they don't mean how it was structures are genetically related. They mean a history of the idea of structure in a somewhat critical mode. I'm trying to show how that procedure has limitations and how the history of genealogy itself leads toward a vicious cycle rather than a virtuous cycle. One of the things that I'm very interested in is the value of self-reference. And I think that there can be both virtuous and vicious circularity. And I want to kind of undo that kind of formation. But that's a very academic oriented book. I also am writing a book about power and an attempt to re-theorize power, in part because I think we can make better social and emancipative change if we have a more clear-eyed view of power and reject a fundamental presupposition that we basically inherited from the postmodernists in the 80s that presumes that power is ubiquitous, subject-forming, and dominating and inescapable. That turns out to be a really shitty view of power if you actually, A, want to do analytical work to describe social relations, and B, if you actually want to change the world, it would seem to suggest that change and positive change is impossible.
Well, Jason, I look forward to both of those, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks again for listening to Damn the Absolute, and I also want to give a shout out to those of you who have recently been talking up Eradicus and Damn the Absolute online, specifically all you folks on Twitter. Thank you, David Harding, Contingently Ironic, Lisa Humbertson, and the Lawn Chair Philosophy Foundation. You can tweet at us at Eradicus Mag or me directly at Jeffrey_Howard_. You can also pester us with some of your favorite quotes from Damn the Absolute guests or pitch us on episode ideas. And again, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. It really goes a long way in helping us to foster a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you all next time.